Welcome to the Diefenbunker, Canada's Cold War Museum. This audio tour will take you four stories below ground and lasts approximately 1 hour. Use this device to start, stop, skip, or go back. Listen for this chime to signal the end of a stop. Central Emergency Government Headquarters, or the Diefenbunker as it was nicknamed, was fully operational by the end of 1961 and stayed in service until 1994. The base was known as Canadian Forces Station CARP, or CFS CARP. It operated in total secrecy in an era when mutual nuclear annihilation between the West and the Soviet bloc seemed dangerously plausible. Even in peacetime, working at CFS CARP could be stressful. Some of the people who worked here, civilian and military, have described their experiences working deep underground. You'll hear some of their voices during this tour. As the seat of the Canadian government, Ottawa was a logical target for attack. The bunker was built to house the emergency government if the capital was bombed. This massive underground building was constructed to withstand the effects of a 5-megaton atomic bomb. In the end, the Cold War ended peacefully thanks in part to careful diplomacy to navigate its crises. Nuclear war was avoided, and the bunker never needed to function as a shelter for an emergency government. Instead, it served Canada as a top-secret communications base for more than 30 years. On your way into the bunker, you pass through the blast tunnel, which was designed to deflect a nuclear shockwave and protected the front doors. The bunker itself can protect, water, and feed 500 people for 30 days, including the Governor General, the Prime Minister, and the War Cabinet. Plus, the essential government, military, and civilian staff necessary to keep the daily operations of the bunker running. If a nuclear bomb had dropped, you wouldn't see any families in here. Activities in the bunker were top secret, and only designated people would have been allowed in. No friends, no family, no children. Personnel arriving through these doors checked in with the security desk and received a color-coded security badge. Depending on the color, personnel could access specific sections of the bunker. Mike Green, a teletype technician in the bunker between 1968 and 1972, explains.
About 85 to 90% of the place I wasn't allowed to go. If you had no need to be in a hallway or in an area, you didn't go there. The badges indicated by different colored stripes whether you were allowed in an area or not. And every time you came to a door, if you didn't have the right color to go in through that door, you didn't go.
Following a catastrophic nuclear attack, anyone arriving at the bunker might have had deadly radiation on their skin and clothes. Please enter the decontamination passage to find out more about the process. A contaminated person would stand in this first shower, fully clothed, and stay there until the radiation control officer told them to proceed. The shower prevented fine irradiated particles like dust from becoming airborne and contaminating the bunker. Watch your step as you come through the undressing area. All your wet clothing would get dumped into the chute on the wall. The chute leads to a protected area where bunker staff would safely dispose of it. Keep going and you'll enter the second shower. This one is for hot water and lots of soap. Anyone entering the bunker after a nuclear blast would have to scrub hard, but carefully. Radiation can enter the bloodstream through any cut or abrasion. Head, ears, nose, nails, and mouth all had to be washed thoroughly. Here, you'd be tested again and sent back through if necessary. Once cleared and inside, the officer would give you a gown and paper slippers, and then you'd be sent down the hall to the medical center for a checkup. Nobody knew what kind of injuries people would come here with, but this medical center was prepared to treat various injuries sustained from a nuclear explosion. Even if everyone entered the bunker healthy, a month is a long time for 500 people to not need some kind of medical treatment. Take a look around and you'll see the operating room with state-of-the-art equipment, an examination room, an office for record keeping, a fully stocked pharmacy, and a 3-bed infirmary with an overflow room down the hall. There's an additional single bed in a room off to the side for those who would need isolation, or for a female patient. Something else you might notice: the beds are chained to the floor, and so are many pieces of equipment. This was necessary because the shockwaves from a 5-megaton blast would have rocked the building and sent loose pieces of equipment flying. The medical center rooms were kept at a lower or negative atmospheric pressure. This helps reduce the spread of airborne diseases. The effects of a prolonged lockdown were unknown, especially if a nuclear war was in progress above. The bunker tried to prepare for everything. The first two cots in the entrance area were for hospital overflow patients, or maybe for a guard if needed. Take a look through the window of the locked door. The room beyond has 3 bunk beds, lockers, and cabinets. What it doesn't have is an inside handle to get out. This room would have been used as a confinement cell for anyone within the bunker with serious medical conditions or those exhibiting dangerous behavior to themselves or other people. Life in the bunker during a nuclear attack would have been extremely stressful. Personnel stationed there would have been deeply affected. Remember, families weren't allowed in the bunker. Even in peacetime, working in the bunker could be demanding. Both civilian and military personnel had to manage the challenges of living deep underground. Radio technician Helen Rosso explains how even the colors were designed to combat psychological stress.
It was supposedly psychologically damaging to us to live in here. And that's why you'll see in some of the columns there were gray and white stripes and all the different colors. They had a special psychologist come in and pick colors and everything. That would happen just before I got here. And more pleasant from not having windows.
From late 1961 to 1994, this small office served as part of the larger Message Control Center, the MCC. All incoming and outgoing messages came through here. MCC staff logged, processed, duplicated, and distributed messages. From this room, messages were recorded onto magnetic tape and passed through the slot in the wall. On the other side of the slot was the encryption room. The light signaled a message was coming through. Encryption is the process of converting plain text into an unreadable code for anyone other than the intended recipient. During the Cold War, encryption was vital in keeping top secret information from falling into Soviet hands. Teletype operator Brenda Langman explains her work using this crucial step in message secrecy.
We had a certain time of day that we had to reset our crypto machines so that, and at the very same time, wherever they lived in the world, the other end of that circuit was also resetting so that our keys, our crypto keys, always matched. Because if one number was wrong on either end, nothing would work. So it was very detailed, painstaking to set the crypto key.
We still use encryption every day, usually to keep passwords and personal information private in our digital world. The bunker was designed to operate when cut off from outside help. If one of the teletype machines, and there were a lot of teletype machines in the bunker, went down, it had to be repaired on site. Teletype machines were the workhorses of government communications from the 1950s until the widespread use of fax machines and computers in the mid-1990s. Teletype machines look like large typewriters, but they are actually secure communication devices. Here's how it works. A military clerk types in a message on the machine at the bunker. Then they send it via a designated cable to another machine elsewhere, perhaps at a departmental office or military base across the country or around the world. The teletype machine there prints out the message. Many office workers from the era remember the familiar sound of busy teletype machines chattering out reams of paper. Teletype operator Brenda Langman remembers the noise.
Clack, 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 and there's this tape shooting out and it's piling up on the ground, and you've got to stand in there with your military boots on and try not to tear any of it, because if you are, you're tearing a message in half, and God help you, because you can't splice it back together.
If the front doors by the blast tunnel were damaged, there were other ways out of the bunker. The two emergency exits, one here and one in the emergency radio room, are narrow 9-meter-long chutes leading to the surface. The chute was filled with 6,800 kilograms of pea gravel so that radiation couldn't enter the bunker after nuclear explosion. Imagine a bomb's gone off. You and your 500 fellow bunkmates have waited for the all-clear. Or perhaps you've run out of food after 30 days. You've been remotely monitoring the situation with a machine called a rad sniffer, and you hope the radiation levels above have diminished enough so they won't make you sick. First, you have to open the steel doors and stand inside the hatch. Then, you pull the metal lever. Pea gravel comes flying down past you and through the grate in the floor. It would have made an incredible racket. The vacuum it creates shatters the plexiglass bubble covering the top. You hope. After that, there's only one way to go. Up. Building the bunker was a feat of the critical path planning method and engineering know-how. In the center of the room is a scale model of the bunker that planners use during the design and construction phases. The model was vital in planning how all the self-contained life support systems and power generation would fit and work in the 4-story building, all completely underground. Different colors represent different ventilation and machinery systems. More than 1,000 workers built the almost 1,000 square meter bunker over the course of 18 months. The main structure required 24,320 cubic meters of hand-poured concrete and sits on 1.5 meters of compacted gravel, which would have absorbed the shock of a nuclear blast. It was almost impossible to keep the building of the bunker a secret. Many residents in Karp wondered at what was being constructed. The public was told it was a communication center, but right from the start, people started calling it the Diefenbunker, after the sitting Prime Minister, John Diefenbaker. During the course of this audio tour, you will visit all 4 floors of the bunker. Right now, we're only on the top level. Have a look at the model and spot the indicator of where you're standing. If all other communication systems failed, there was still radio. Military radio is usually point-to-point, not necessarily broadcast, unless it was connected to a transmitter. A buried cable connected the bunker to a transmitter in Perth, Ontario, some 60 kilometers away. Operators here could use both the low-frequency and very high-frequency radio equipment to connect with the rest of the world, whatever was left of it. As Canadian Forces Station Carp, military signalers stationed here used radio to connect to other bases in Canada and across the world. Brian Jeffrey, a former civilian electronics technician contracted to the Canadian military, shares the importance of radio communication from his radar station across Canada during the Cold War. Once you're ready, return to the welcome desk and descend the A-level stairwell next to the freight elevator. If you need to use the elevator, please ask a staff member to assist you. Go down one floor to the 300 level, where the emergency government of Canada would have conducted their nuclear war. It's also where you'll find the most top-secret room in the building. Had nuclear war broken out and the emergency government been sequestered here at the bunker, the politicians and the military would have needed accurate and timely intelligence to make military decisions. They would need to get their orders out quickly and securely, safe from enemy monitoring. The communications room you're standing in was very secure. Few people in the bunker had access to this room. Next door to the Federal Warning Center, the comms room contained loud teletype machines and was remarkably well soundproofed. Long before faxes, email, texting, and Wi-Fi, sturdy and reliable teletype machines connected the bunker with NORAD, the North American Air Defense Command Centers in North Bay, Ontario, and Colorado Springs in the United States. The bunker's underground location helped protect top-secret North American intelligence from Soviet surveillance. Go ahead and check your cell phone. What kind of coverage do you get in the bunker? Military officials in the Federal Warning Center had the critical responsibility of monitoring the military and supply situation throughout Canada using information from NORAD's Ballistic Missile Early Warning System. NORAD, which stands for North America Air Defense Command, is a joint organization of Canada and the United States, which provides aerospace warning of incoming attacks. In 1957, the Russians successfully tested an intercontinental ballistic missile for the first time, which could reach any part of the world. NORAD was created in 1958 and incorporated three successive lines of radar monitoring known as the Pine Tree Line, Mid-Canada Line, and the Distant Early Warning System Line, or DEW Line. In 1961, the Americans set up a fourth line known as the Ballistic Missile Early Warning System. This room once held a unique piece of technology called an iconorama, an early electronic map that plotted vehicle movement across North America in real time. Wayne Marshall, a signaler in the bunker, describes the process of sighting Russian movements through North American airspace.
And sometimes these flash messages came in very, very rapid succession. They might be air, they might be submarines, and sometimes a lot of it was done just to test us to see if we could deal with it. It was done by the Russians on purpose to agitate us. They might sight Russian aircraft that intruded into our space. We called them bears. A Russian bear was a type of aircraft just loaded with electronic equipment, just loaded. They're watching us, and we're watching them. That's the Cold War. Watching all the time.
Updates and situation reports received next door in the comms room were plotted out on the iconorama. Officials here would have briefed the War Cabinet on the situation, advising the Prime Minister and the Emergency Cabinet. Emergency preparedness drills were conducted at the bunker for many of its operational years. In an emergency, when nuclear missiles were in the air, perhaps falling on cities across Canada, it was vital that people knew who was in charge. Maintaining the chain of command, the continuity of government, was the main purpose of the bunker. According to Canada's constitution, a legal government must consist of at least five specific people. Imagine the Prime Minister seated at the head of the table and the Governor General opposite, flanked by at least three Crown Ministers. Here is where top-level decisions would have been made in a time of crisis. It's easy to imagine this tense room filled with cigarette smoke. Six clocks above the door reminded everyone that the country was in danger from coast to coast to coast. The televisions suspended from the ceiling are on a closed circuit to the Emergency Government Situation Center, or MGovSitsen, located across the hall. The televisions would have kept the government informed of up-to-the-minute events and situations. The War Cabinet Room is directly between the Federal Warning Center and the MGovSitsen. The Warning Center provided military information, while the MGovSitsen was connected with the civic situation. Both kinds of information were needed for the emergency government to make good decisions. All orders from the War Cabinet were passed on to the Secretariat next door, stamped with the Great Seal of Canada, and appropriately distributed to civilian or military authorities. Essentially, the War Cabinet is where a thin but legitimate emergency government would have functioned in a time of cataclysmic national crisis. Have a seat in the Prime Minister's chair and imagine what it might have been like to have the weight of this responsibility on your shoulders. The Secretariat disseminated orders from the War Cabinet. Effectively, it operated like the Privy Council, the Treasury Board, and the Prime Minister's office rolled into one. About 20 people would have staffed this room. They would have briefed and provided support for government decisions and coordinated the flow of information between various governmental departments and agencies. The Great Seal of Canada is under the protection of the Registrar General, who would have brought it with them when they came to the bunker. The seal stamped all state documents produced by Parliament, making them official. Two general types of information were needed to make good decisions in a nuclear crisis: military information and civilian information. The Emergency Government Situation Center, or MGovSitsen for short, handled the civilian side of communications. Personnel stationed in MGovSitsen tracked the damage and fallout of a nuclear attack on Canada using charts, maps, video monitoring, and overhead cameras. The room is divided into two areas: the infrastructure assessment area and the casualty and damage assessment area. Staff would have assessed infrastructure during and after a nuclear attack, keeping up to speed with conditions of transportation systems, agriculture, telecoms, housing, hospitals, power sources, and industry. Reports came in from officials staffed within regional and municipal Diefenbunkers within each province, and nuclear fallout was recorded by nuclear detonation detection system sites across the country. The status board, labeled the MGov Facilities Board, shows the activation status of other regional bunkers across Canada. The casualty and damage assessment area monitored the impact and result of attacks on the civilian population using the backlit status map. This map pinpointed the location of nuclear explosions using NORAD command reports. The alert status board adjacent to the map would have been kept up to date during a crisis. An overhead camera points to the large map with a plastic overlay, which tracks the travel direction of radioactive fallout. All of the information would have been sent to monitors throughout the bunker, including the War Cabinet. Original phones in this room had a clamp on the handset. This helped secure the phone lines against shockwaves initiated by a nearby nuclear bomb blast. Listen to David Peters of Emergency Preparedness Canada describe emergency drills conducted in this room.
But we managed to have a few exercises, mostly lasting, I think it was 36 to 48 hours, in which we would practice what would happen in the event of a nuclear war in Canada. We're simply trying to practice the flow of information, because our job is basically flowing information from outside sources and from sources we had here, analyzing it, collating it, and presenting it to Cabinet so Cabinet can make whatever decisions it had to make at the time.
Hello. the bunker was essential to the continuity of government in the event of a nuclear crisis. Not only was there an executive government in the form of the War Cabinet, but select government departments had to function as well. 18 offices on the 300 and 400 level would have provided 24-hour support to their respective ministers. Look down the corridor and you'll see the Department of Transportation, the Department of Public Works, and the Department of Energy, Mines, and Resources. Government agencies were also part of the bunker's operations. For example, the Canadian Housing and Mortgage Corporation had an office here. This agency would have helped establish temporary accommodations for displaced citizens. Take a look into the recreated offices, making note of the desks. Bunker psychologists determined that bright colors would help people in a lockdown situation cope with catastrophic conditions up top. These offices reflect that design decision. You are entering the most top secret and secure room in the bunker. Welcome to OSACS. Teletype operator Janet Puddicombe was one of the few allowed through these doors.
Like there was many, many places in here that were restricted to a lot of people. And, you know, if you worked in OSACS, OSACS was the most restricted area. And that's where I worked most of the time, was in there.
The bunker's official name was Canadian Forces Station CARP. Between 1962 and 1995, the station was an active player in the global shift to computerized communications. The Ottawa Semi-Automatic Exchange, known as OSACS, was built into the bunker in 1981 to replace a larger facility on the 400 level. OSACS was the hub of military communications, connecting the bunker to a domestic and international network of receiver stations. Once the doors were shut, the metal-clad room becomes what is known in the military as a Faraday cage. That means it is totally secure from outside electronic surveillance and can withstand the electromagnetic pulses emanating from a nuclear blast that would otherwise disable or destroy electronic devices. Entrance to this room was limited to those with top-secret clearance. The two Burroughs B4800 computers, similar to those here, handled more than 100,000 messages a month. The large computers required a lot of ventilation and cabling. Much of that is contained underneath the raised floor. The only connection to the outside world from this room is the secure fiber optic cable through the wall. Sleeping quarters in the bunker were strictly segregated along traditional gender lines. In all, the bunker today features 7 women's quarters. Many women lived in the bunker during its operational years. Originally, planners thought women would serve as nurses during a nuclear crisis, or in administrative support roles. But had a nuclear crisis required politicians and the Governor General to take shelter in the bunker, up to 110 women would have potentially lived and worked here. As the Cold War progressed through the 1960s and 70s, women made some headway in achieving equality. Increasingly, women were occupying positions of political power and taking on more varied roles in the military. The women who worked in the bunker fulfilled a range of roles in administration, communications, security, and medical support. Some women who worked here described conditions as very collegial. According to radio technician Helen Rosso,
I mean, it was work, you know, it was like anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of people put things into the context that aren't really there. It's like, it's a working environment. I mean, you see it anywhere else too nowadays, so it's no different.
The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation had an important role in the event of a nuclear war. In its emergency capacity, the bunker would have housed 11 CBC staff to carry out emergency broadcast duties. As sirens sounded across the country, citizens would have gathered in their home or community shelters. From there, the nation was advised to listen on their battery-operated radios to CBC on the emergency broadcast frequencies. Every broadcast on those frequencies came out of this room.
Repeat, this is a real emergency. This is the Canadian Emergency Broadcasting System. An enemy attack on North America has been detected. Sirens are now sounding or have sounded the attack warning. Listen for further instructions.
Notice how the equipment in the production studio rests on rubber mats. These would have absorbed the shock of a nuclear blast, steadying the equipment. Privacy was not possible for most people in the bunker. The Prime Minister and the Governor General were the only two who had their own private suite. The first room is the office of the Prime Minister's secretary. Through that is the Prime Minister's office, and further in, the Prime Minister's bedroom and private bathroom. From these rooms, the sitting Prime Minister would have carried out the leadership of a Cold War turned hot. At the time of the bunker's construction, that Prime Minister was John Diefenbaker. Diefenbaker served as Prime Minister between 1957 and 1963. He appointed the first woman to a cabinet position, Ellen Fairclough, and the first Indigenous person to the Senate, Ake Namuka, also known as James Gladstone, of the Kainai First Nation. His government also passed the Canadian Bill of Rights. Diefenbaker found it hard to convince Canadians of the need to protect the nation against a nuclear attack. In 1957, in Parliament, he is quoted saying, "People do not want to believe there is going to be an atomic bombing of Canada. The thought disturbs our equanimity. We like to look at the situation as though we were protected and insulated by many thousands of miles of sea and a northern ice cap. It is going to require an educational campaign to make the people realize the danger in which we find ourselves." The single bed highlights a harsh reality. No one, not even the Prime Minister, could bring their family with them. Diefenbaker himself never set foot in the bunker. Many believe that had there been a nuclear attack, Diefenbaker would have refused to come to the bunker without his beloved wife Olive. Diefenbaker was not alone in making this difficult choice. Everyone who was posted to the bunker was supposed to have made separate arrangements for the safety of their families in a nuclear war. Gary Dowd, who worked in a variety of communications roles in the bunker, and radio technician Helen Rosso, describe how they felt about the so-called no-family rule.
The other thing was always in my mind when I got married, I might have to come in here and never see my wife again, or see my young baby boy, because you would have to report for duty. If there was a threat, you might never see them again. They'd be ashes. It was in your mind. It had to be. Because that was the way things were put to you then.
Would you come in and leave your family? Or would you stay with your family? And that was, you know, we asked that question of many people and said, what would your dilemma be? Would you come in to protect the site and work the communications, or would you stay with your family? And I think it was about 50-50 what the guy said. Because they said if it's a nuclear attack, basically the only ones that are going to survive are the ones in the bunker.
When you are finished here, find the stairs and take them down to the 200-100 level. Please be careful as you descend and pay attention to some of the raised steps between rooms below. Although not open to the public, you can observe the machine room from the mezzanine level. Every breath you take in the bunker today is courtesy of this room. As the beating heart of the bunker, the engines were kept all systems going, especially in the event of a nuclear strike. Outside the bunker, infrastructure such as power stations and pipelines would doubtlessly have been damaged. Fallout radiation would have poisoned air and water. Power to the bunker usually comes from Ontario Hydro. During a lockdown, the bunker could generate its own power using four diesel engines, the green engine on the main floor. There were five fuel tanks, four outside and one inside. When standing on the platform, the four metal valves for the outside tanks are located behind you. Fresh water for the bunker came from two wells. The silver tanks were part of a heat recovery system which provided hot water. At the end of the main machine room floor is the air filtration room. The filters worked in three stages. First, a coarse filter. Secondly, a HEPA filter. And then an activated charcoal filter. A radiation detection device located on the surface, or a rad sniffer as it was known, sent a signal to this room if radiation levels were toxic. The bunker would then be sealed and would have to rely on its own system for the next 30 days. The engineers and machine operators who worked here were essential to survival. Wayne Byrne, a machine room operator between 1967 and 1983, describes the crucial work of testing the machinery for a lockdown situation.
There was no room for mistakes. You had to know what you were doing. And it was sort of, it was nerve-wracking the first two or three times. But after you had a few test runs and a few, especially the real power failure where we had a humongous storm outside and all of a sudden everything would just go black, it was a shock to the system.
The heavily fortified Bank of Canada vault was constructed separately from the rest of the bunker. As you walk along the corridor, you are leaving the main bunker building, though you are still 23 meters or 75 feet underground. Because of its cooler temperature, bunker personnel once used this corridor as an exercise area. During a nuclear war, the Bank of Canada vault would have safeguarded the Federal Gold Reserve. Until relatively recently, Canada, like most countries around the world, backed up its paper currency with reserves of real gold. The vault was designed to hold about 72 tons of the precious metal. Before entering the vault, have a close look at the doors, but please do not touch them, as your hands might damage the protective grease coating. The smaller door had to be opened first in order to equalize the pressure inside. If the small door wasn't opened first, the pressure would have kept the large door completely sealed, even if unlocked. The large door weighs anywhere from 10 to 30 tons. Opening the massive locking system required four people, each with a unique combination known only to them. A narrow space forms a square around the outside of the central vault. This was an extra security measure. At each corner is a mirror, which allowed a sentry to see completely around the central structure from one spot. Although Canada's gold was never kept here, preparations for its arrival were triggered by the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. You are now at the bottom of the bunker, directly below the kitchen. The areas down here were designed mostly for food storage. Feeding 500 bunker residents for a month took enormous planning and considerable supplies. The walk-in cold storage was stocked with fresh vegetables, fruit, and meat. When fresh food ran out after a week of lockdown, bunker residents would have then relied on packaged military rations. A small elevator brought food directly to the kitchen. Every day for over 30 years, the bunker kitchen served four meals a day to the hundreds of military and civilian staff stationed here. Thousands upon thousands of meals were stored in this area. The walk-in cold storage had a grim dual purpose. During a lockdown, no one could go outside. Everyone had to wait for the radiation levels to drop. In the meantime, if anyone died inside the bunker, their burial would also have to wait. The cold storage would have acted as a morgue, storing cadavers until a safe burial was possible. Watch your step as you exit. A raised floor guard on the floor would have protected storage areas if the grease trap to your right spilled out. For more than 30 years, the Canadian military ran the bunker as Canadian Forces Station CARP. Many hundreds of people, both military and civilian, were stationed here. For most of the 1960s, they lived here 24/7. By the 1970s, most personnel lived outside the bunker and commuted to CFS CARP. Emergency preparedness drills necessitated the occasional lockdown, just to keep in practice should there be an escalation of Cold War tensions into a full-blown nuclear war. For those stationed here, recreation and food were important ways to reduce the stress of living and working in the bunker. If you were one of the few admitted into the bunker during lockdown, each minute of your bunker existence would have been scheduled and enforced. Where and when you slept, when and with whom you ate, worked, and relaxed, what chores you were responsible for, even what route you walked along within the building. One part of the dining hall was devoted to recreation, where both men and women would play cards, darts, and shuffleboard. Even historic events would play out in this room. Michael DeNoble, a facilities operator, remembers watching the 1972 Canada-Soviet Hockey Summit Series.
The biggest event that happened, I would have to say, when I was in CARP, was when Paul Henderson scored the goal to beat the Russians. They had it piped out through the bunker, and I was working when he scored, and everybody just went nuts.
Look around the corner to find the Canex, which was like a neighborhood grocery store, where personnel could purchase small items like snacks and cigarettes. Military psychologists visited the bunker to advise on ways to reduce stress. One very important recommendation was to get outside whenever possible. People stationed at CFS CARP fondly recall baseball games and social events such as the Winter Carnival. Good food was essential to keeping people happy. In order to accommodate the 24-hour working schedule of the bunker, the kitchen was constantly preparing or serving meals. John Publicover, who worked in the kitchen from 1966 to 1976, describes the schedule.
When you're on shift work, like when I came here first, you fed 24 hours a day. Like you fed breakfast, then you have like a coffee break in the morning at 10 o'clock. Then you have lunch, and then you have a 3 o'clock break. Then you have supper. Then you have a 9 o'clock lunch. And then you have 12 o'clock a meal, a full meal. Then you have a 3 o'clock lunch in the morning. And then you have breakfast again. So you had a meal every 3 hours or 4 hours.
Fresh food was delivered every Monday from Uplands Military Base in Ottawa, enough food to feed 150 people for 7 days. But during a lockdown, the kitchen would have been supplied with enough fresh food to feed 500 for a week before the kitchen turned to rations, known as individual meal packs, or meal replacement kits similar to rations in the field. The kitchen had a walk-in freezer, a refrigerator, and a cooler. A small elevator connected the kitchen to more storage areas on the floor below. The spacious dining room could accommodate 150 to 200 people at a time. Many of them appreciated the fresh food options available to them. Here is teletype operator Janet Puddicombe.
It was the best mess I had ever eaten in. The food was always good, it was always hot, and if you didn't like what was on the menu, they'd make you something else. I think a lot of people got spoiled by the meals here. It was the best mess I'd ever eaten in.
CFS CARP was a military operation with a specific hierarchy. A small room to the right of the serving area was for non-commissioned officers dining, and a closed room next to it was for senior officers. Everyone else ate in the main dining area. Find the large photo mural in the dining area. Although installed to create a sense of spaciousness, it's impossible not to imagine men and women staring at it during a nuclear war. The no family rule meant your loved ones would have likely perished while you kept the government running down here. But the lovely mountain scene would have also been a reminder of what you were protecting, both in an imagined disaster that never happened, and for those hundreds of men and women who served here for 32 years. Select the last track to hear how the Cold War came to a peaceful end.
Gate is really quite extraordinary. West Germans have climbed up in a section of the wall. They're standing about 10 deep, looking over on the other side at soldiers on the other side. They're cheering, they're taking photographs, they're popping champagne corks. It's a party scene that's going to go on the whole evening. Berlin is still technically a divided city, but standing here at the Brandenburg Gate, you'd never know it.
In 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev became the leader of the Soviet Union. He was determined to reform his country and to end the arms race with the United States. In 1989, the Berlin Wall, which symbolized the divide between the West and the Soviet bloc, fell. On December 3, 1989, at the Malta summit, Gorbachev and President George Bush Sr. declared the Cold War over. From 1989 to 1991, a series of political events eventually led to the dissolution of the Soviet Union and what many considered the end of the Cold War. Gradually, Canada withdrew its troops from Germany, military spending was cut, the network of air raid sirens across the country was decommissioned. People around the world collectively sighed in relief and began to look back upon how close we had come to nuclear annihilation. When the bunker closed in 1994, the military emptied it of all equipment and furniture. The bunker was purchased by a local group of volunteers who saw the value in conserving this emblematic artifact of Canada in the Cold War. When you leave the bunker, look around outside. Notice how unnoticeable the bunker was designed to be, the result of careful preparedness in a time of nuclear anxiety. The staff and volunteers at the Diefen Bunker would like to thank you for your interest in this unique National Historic Site. Your contribution keeps our not-for-profit museum operating. The Diefen Bunker, Canada's Cold War Museum, is dedicated to presenting stories of the Cold War, including Canada's emergency preparedness and promoting peaceful ways for conflict resolution. We are honored that many former workers and military personnel have shared with us their stories of life in the Diefen Bunker and Canada during the Cold War. When you are finished, please return to the top level where you can return this device to the same place where you picked it up. Thank you for listening.